Welcome to Foibles, where my mom and I record conversations we have anyway. I'm Zoe.
I'm Zoe's mom. Oh yeah, that's right. I have a name. It's Frida. Talking about our greatest obsession right now.
Our recent favorite.
Totally in love with?
Perry Mason.
Perry Mason.
The ineffable.
The ineffable. The well, how did you phrase him?
A mattress of a man.
He is, well, as played by Raymond Burr.
Right.
Yeah, he's a mattress of a man as played by Raymond Burr with bedroom eyes, right. As I like to say. Well, I first got acquainted with Perry when I was probably about 3 or 4 years old. So this would have been like in 62, about 4, 61, 62. So the show, the Perry Mason show, which started in 1957, had been going for a few years. And it had a fabulous, fabulous score for the show, the intro. And then,
da-na-na-na,
well, then you should just insert it.
Right. Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
So you're going to insert that, right? You're going to edit that out. Okay. And, and so I remember my parents, my dad would watch this show, and it was after my bedtime. So I'd be up in my bed at 4 years old, and I would hear this music by Fred Steiner, fabulous score, but it scared the bejesus out of me. I thought that show must be so scary with that music. The score by Fred Steiner, wrote the music, is just emblematic of the time. I mean, it's got the drama, it's got the kind of the 60s kind of jazziness,
yeah.
The sleeky slinkiness and everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that
it kind of maybe symbolizes Perry's own approach in court. He kind of sneaks up on the witnesses, da na 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 na, and then he gets them.
And then he's all satisfied afterwards. Wah, 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 wah,
right.
Wah, wah.
That's the sort of smoking cigarette in bed after.
That, well, that's when he goes home with Della Street,
right.
Which we will get to Della Street later. Goes home and hangs out with Della with his sin. His post-coital cigarettes.
Yeah.
That's really good. I hadn't thought of that. And then it wasn't until I was in graduate school in the 80s when they were doing reruns of Perry in syndication on one of the local channels. It was on every single night, and I'd come home after a long day of dancing and working, and I'd sit down with my cat, Robert J. Bob, and we would watch Perry Mason, and I just became addicted. I watched it every single night, 5 nights a week, for a couple of years. And I may have seen all the episodes. It's quite possible. Fabulous.
How did Robert J. Bob like it?
Robert J. Bob, he grooved on it.
Yeah.
He was pretty. He pretty much. He liked to sit underneath the curtains and watch it.
So he might have been a little bit scared.
I think he was. I think it did. I think it did freak him out a little bit. But
watching through the blankets.
Yeah. Kind of right. Because he didn't put his paws over his eyes, but he did look out through the sheer blanket, the sheer curtains, and watch Perry. And then, recently, right, over a few months ago. I said,
You brought it home from Scarecrow Video.
Right, Scarecrow Video in Seattle, Washington.
Yep.
what, but over almost
200,000 individual titles.
Is it?
Yep.
Wow, up to 200,000.
Well,
now.
Over 200,000, 20 individual titles.
Oh my gosh.
220,000 individual titles.
I didn't know that. That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
It's a great place to check out.
Yeah, you absolutely. So that's a free plug for Scarecrow Video because we love it.
That's right.
Anyway, so I brought it home from Scarecrow Video, and because throughout Zoe's life, she's now 23, but starting practically from the time she was conscious, I knew I had to educate her on old film and TV and things like that because I didn't think that the current zeitgeist would lead her in that direction. So I wanted to make sure that she knew all about old film. And I remember very well the first time she was probably, I don't know, 6 or 7. We watched the first time a black and white film. And when you're watching, she goes, "I can't see anything! I can't see anything!"
I really did. I
thought... You did. You could. I can understand that. But, of course, I was raised with black and white TV and black and white film. So, but it was so funny, even though I understand why you felt that way. But I'm like, watch it anyway.
Yeah. Now my eyes trained.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. See, they're educated eyes. So, anyway, I brought home Perry because I thought she should at least see one episode just to have it as a touchstone because it's mimicked. It's referred to. I mean, the Perry Mason.
I guess what we should say is that it's a lawyer. It's a TV show about this lawyer.
Oh, I guess go ahead. Yeah. Of course, I assume everyone knows who Perry Mason
right.
is. You go ahead.
And half the people I mention it to do, and half the people don't. It tends to be like a decade about that divides the two. But
who knows and who doesn't? What age wise? Did you notice?
I mean, definitely younger people of my generation have no idea what it is, and even people who are in their 30s tend to have no idea at all. But then the regulars at the bar that I hang out with, you know, they all know about Perry
because they're all like 40s and 50s,
right? So it's a TV show that was filmed in the 50s and 60s and ran for a really long time.
And the star of it was the main character was an attorney,
right?
Rough.
A criminal attorney, right? Defense attorney.
Yeah, criminal defense attorney, but for some reason he seemed to take anything that walked through the door. He did,
right.
One of the episodes he started out with a contract case, right. Which turned into a murder.
Of course, it always does. You know, he just has a nose.
Yeah, he has a nose for it, I guess, but he took things that were not, I saw him take a contract case, he took a defamation thing, so... Okay, yeah, but nominally he is a criminal defense attorney, and he never loses, and this is where it comes in. He's never loses.
He's famous within his own universe.
Totally famous. Anybody on the street, you say Perry Mason, they're like, Perry Mason?
Oh, yeah.
And he always skirts the edge. He's in the gray area. He's never really, really lacking in...
In, like, moral fiber.
Yeah, or his ethics.
Uprightness, yeah.
He follows the rules, kind of.
He follows the spirit of the law, because he is the spirit of the law embodied. But he will sort of take preemptive action to make evidence that will be relevant later and things like that. Like, I saw him go out to the highway and, like, shoot two bullets into a tree, and then that later came into play because the other gun hadn't been fired that was identical and stuff like that, and that's how he proved it.
Yeah, he proved it, but he does it by doing something that's outside the box, shall we say.
Right.
And then the district attorney who always loses,
always.
That's Hamilton Berger, he always loses, poor guy. And so he's always saying how Perry Mason is resorting to trickery. Your Honor, this is Mr. Mason is engaging in his usual old tricks. Exactly. So there's that. But so that's Perry, and he's just dynamite in the courtroom. He's always kind of thinking on his feet and coming up with a legal angle and breaking witnesses down on the stand. And I mean, there's nothing better that there's the famous trope. Mm-hmm. In legal films and so forth, where the lawyer batters the witness, batters him with, "Is it not true? Is it not true? Did you?" And the witness just breaks down.
I
and goes
don't know.
Down,
no, and, it wasn't me. And then, me.
And then they go, all right, it was me. I did it. Or he batters someone that the killer cares about, and the killer leaps up in the back of the courtroom and says, "Stop it! Stop it! It was me! It was me!"
Right.
So brilliant sometimes.
Yeah.
So brilliant. And anyway, so that trope really, I think, comes from Perry Mason.
You think it comes from Perry
Mason? I do. I think it does. Oh. I think that's why Perry Mason, because remember, Perry Mason, the first book was written in, or published, I should say, in 1933.
Yeah.
So it's way older than the TV show. Right. TV show came more, 25 years after the first book, and those books were famous until then, and there were several film versions of it, which we will talk about in a bit, but we probably should lay the landscape. Do you want to tell about some of the other characters that are standard?
There's some very important like rooks and castles and knights surrounding Perry and his ivory tower of legal spiritual.
And in the chessboard, Perry is really not so much the king. Right. He's the queen.
That's right.
Because the queen is the most powerful piece on the board.
Right.
Right.
So he has at his side the loyal Della Street. She's, of course, our favorite. Of course.
Of course.
She is the epitome of competence.
She's his secretary. His confidential secretary.
And potential fiancé?
Yes, they don't make it clear in the show. They don't go there in the show, but it seems like they
go on an awful lot of trips together.
They
cruises.
Do. And whenever he's eating out, Della's there. They always leave the office together.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes her elbow as they leave the office, if you notice like that. So it's kind of hinted at that there's something a bit going on between them outside the office.
Right.
Yeah.
So she's wonderful. She always has a twinkle in her eye. She always knows what's going on. She always kind of positions Perry to make the most impact.
And she's quite a feminist, really. Even though she plays the role of secretary and seems to play the standard woman's role. And she sometimes in an episode, she'll have like one sentence that she says.
Right.
But when there's a woman in trouble, Della is the one who goes to bat for that woman and gets Perry to back her up or to represent her. And Della's always in the back, sort of comforting the woman or cheering her on. And
helping her with her love life, things like that.
Being happy for her, not a jealous bone in her body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's very secure in her relationship with Perry.
Right. And she's so stylish, too. We love her style.
She is for the period she is in.
Pretty knockout, just some of the outfits
and
she
wears. Beautiful. And she's played by an actress named Barbara Hale, who is still alive.
Still alive.
She's over 100, isn't she? She's
I think so,
at least
100,
but maybe 101.
Yeah.
She's still alive, and which is pretty great.
Yeah.
Oh, we should say that the best Perry in the mattress of a man with the bedroom eyes is Raymond Burr.
Of course, There are other films.
There are other Perrys, but he is the Perry.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've checked it out, too.
Yeah, we've seen all of them, and he's the best Perry.
We did the work for you.
Yeah, we did. You need to go to no other Perry. That is the Perry. And there's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But there's a Perry Mason Returns. There's the Perry Mason original show, the black and white, when Raymond Burr was young. And it started in 1957, and I think it ran 9 years. So it ran through 1966, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then later, when Raymond Burr's quite old, all gray and elderly and roomy and, you know, they did Perry Mason Returns. And I do not recommend that. I don't watch it. I don't think it's worthwhile. But the earlier Perry.
Yeah.
Have we mentioned his hair?
We haven't mentioned his hair. But first, let's lay the other characters.
Okay, let's do that. And then we'll dig more into...
His hair.
Okay. Because I do love that hair.
So we talked a little bit about
Della.
And then Hamilton Berger.
We love, you know, Hamilton Berger was played by William Talbot.
Yeah. He's redhead, right?
I guess. I don't know. It's black and white. It's hard to tell.
Redhead.
Yeah. But he's supposed to be like the nemesis for Perry. He's the district attorney who's always gets the wrong person, always puts him on trial. Perry is the one who, brings out the actual murderer.
Right. He does some things. There's a lot of objections that always fly between the two of them.
Yes.
Like, this is incompetent, immaterial.
And irrelevant. Yes.
Irrelevant, yeah. So they go back and forth, and he's supposed to be a good...
Attorney.
He just, you know, pales in comparison to Perry.
You know,
and becomes... Perry basically reduces him to, like, a juvenile jelly of a lawyer.
Going, I object... And he says it this way. Your Honor, I object.
Yeah. So behind him is the actual, maybe the bronze and cunning of that sort of side of the operation is Lieutenant Tragg.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if he's the cunning, but he certainly is the one who has kind of an overview of humanity that's a bit cynical, a bit skeptical, if you will.
Yeah.
Doesn't get ruffled very often.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a gargoyle. You described him as a gargoyle.
He's a total gargoyle of a man. He was actually a very famous, I shouldn't say famous, like, he was a very famous character actor. He had an amazing career, the guy who played Lieutenant Trag, whose name I cannot come up with right now.
I can't remember either.
Darn it. But he was in, let me see, I've got it written down here. Ray Collins was his name.
Yeah.
And he was in he had an amazing career. He was in Citizen Kane.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Orson Welles' Citizen Kane.
Did he have a major part?
No, but he had a speaking part.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, but that's like been considered the best movie in the
world
for decades. He was in The Magnificent Ambersons, which was another Orson Welles movie. He was in The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer. That had Cary Grant and Shirley Temple.
Say the title again.
The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer.
What? The Bobby Soxer?
Oh, you know what that is? No. Oh, my gosh. Okay, in the 1940s, the young people who did the jitterbug and stuff, and the girls would wear those short socks. They wear the big skirts and the short little white socks.
Yeah.
Those are Bobby Socks.
Oh.
So she's a Bobby Soxer. I mean, she's a teenager. She's a hep teenager.
Yeah.
And she's in love with Cary Grant. But Cary Grant, of course, is in love with her aunt, who is Myrna Loy.
Ooh.
Now, we're going to be talking about Myrna Loy,
Myrna Loy
in the Thin Man series. That'll be another podcast because it's fantastic. He was also in The Desperate Hours with Bogey, Humphrey Bogart. And so he had really a major Hollywood career as a character actor, and then he ended up at the end. He's in the 70s when he's here. But he is a gargoyle, and he wears this hat that looks like a big, like a sombrero that he wears on the side of his head. I don't know. It just doesn't look like it fits him or something, you know?
Yeah, it's very funny, kind of slouchy, shorter than everybody else. But he always comes in at the end sometimes. Sometimes he'll come in at the end for like a clever little
repartee, a little bon mot.
Joke. Yeah. Perry, the episodes always end on some kind of joke and everybody laughing together in the office.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So those are some of the people in it.
We missed, though, I kind of jumped the gun there, starting with Hamilton Berger and Trag. We missed Paul Drake.
Oh my God, Paul Drake!
He's the knight to Perry's queen, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. He's the investigator, private investigator who always is getting information for Perry.
Right.
He's played by William Hopper, or as I like to say, William Hopper.
Every time he comes on screen for the first time,
yes, William Hopper, and he was actually the son of a famous columnist in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, Hedda Hopper.
Oh.
And she wore these crazy hats. But she's a very powerful figure. And she did, like...
What kind of column?
Oh, celebrity gossip.
Okay.
But those people, Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper, were sort of the two of them. And they had, wielded a lot of power. And they could ruin people with negative publicity. Because that time, you know, now they have, you know, Rob Lowe has sex on camera and everybody releases it. Yet somehow his career goes on. He might have taken a little bit of a knock. But back then, you find out somebody got pregnant out of wedlock.
Puritanical.
And at the end of your career, my friend, you're done. So they had a lot of power. And his mother definitely has been known that she allegedly, as far as I know, blackmailed people.
Wow.
That she had links with Herbert Hoover. Not Herbert Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
The head of the FBI. Had links with him.
Wow.
She was very conservative, anti-communist. So during that 50s period, she really was a player, and that was her son, and she wanted him to be an actor. He's very tall. I think he was 6'5", with silver hair. He was a World War II vet.
Supposed to be kind of like good looking and like dashing.
Yeah,
like
very supposedly not a good actor. He's okay as Paul Drake, but he's just not a good actor.
And we saw his screen test as Perry Mason, and it was terrible.
Yeah,
it was bad.
Yeah, when they were trying to figure out who would be Perry, William Hopper, he did a screen test as Perry Mason. It was terrible. And then Raymond Burr did a screen test for the district attorney Hamilton Berger part.
Right.
Not terrible, but not that great either.
No.
They were made to play those roles. And William Hopper didn't want to be an actor. He really, his mother kind of pushed him into it.
Wow.
It wasn't really what he wanted to do, but, you know, he did it. And he was, you know, so he... he got a good gig there with Perry Mason. Died kind of young of cancer, I think. It's kind of sad. So,
who anyway. Was it that had the Wild House Party?
Oh no. William Tallman, who played Hamilton Berger, he was arrested and put on trial for being at this wild party. Supposedly there's nudity and drugs and all this kind of stuff. And so the story on the internet you see is, oh, he got kicked off Perry Mason and, you know, he did all this stuff. Well, what it turns out, the facts are, is, yeah, he was arrested and he was put on trial. And then the district attorney was kind of chastised by the judge because they found that he was not guilty.
Wow.
He didn't do anything. He wasn't there.
Oh, he wasn't even there.
Yeah, but he got kicked off the show because there was always what they called the morals clause in the contracts in those days. When you had a contract, if you did anything lacking in morals, such as going to wild parties and having drugs,
oh, yeah.
Then they could fire you. That was a way for them to be able to fire you. And so they fired him, but then he was exonerated. And so I guess he was only off the show for a few months, and then he came back. Which is good because even though they had other people play the part, and they were okay. There's just something about that Hamilton Berger energy between him and Perry Mason that just, it works.
He's like a dog to Perry's cat, I think.
Could be, yeah. And Perry's always one with the claws unsheathed that just scratches the nose of the dog, and the dog goes running back into his kennel.
Right.
You know? And then looks out and barks.
Yeah, totally. Goes to the owner.
Yeah, yes. So, okay, let's talk a little. We can talk a little bit. Should we talk a little bit more about the show or the movies? Or where do you think we should go next with this?
So we've talked about the main players, the music. Let's talk about Errol Stanley Gardner.
Okay. Oh, did we mention that the music was written by a Fred Steiner?
You did, yes.
I did, okay. Fantastic music. I would listen to it just on my iPod. It's so good. Love it.
Let's take a little break here. I'm going to blow my nose really quickly.
Okay.
I'm going to cut this out.
Burr, 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 burr.
All right. Moving on. I've got a little bit of a cold today.
True. True enough. Okay, all right. Well, actually, since we talked a little bit about the characters, I actually would like to talk a little bit about how they interact in the show, maybe?
Yeah, sure.
A little bit more about Della and Perry, do you think? Some more to say there?
There's got to be. We can figure it out. so we love Della so much, not only because of her sort of feminist touch, shall we say, to the show, but because she has sort of an aura of calm. She's like kind of the eye of the hurricane always in my perspective. She and Perry, but
and Barbara Hale was she's very beautiful. Yeah, obviously that's a kind of what they would do, and she really didn't have much of a career. I mean, she did a few things before she was on Perry Mason, but she didn't have much of a career. I think she was in a couple famous movies. She was in Jolson Sings Again, which is a movie, a second biopic about Al Jolson. And she was in a really pretty famous movie called The Boy with the Green Hair, which is an anti-war parable movie. And she was in that. And then later, after Perry Mason, later in her life, she was in the movie Airport.
Oh, really?
Not Airplane, but Airport, which is a disaster movie that she was in. So, but she didn't have really that much of a career. She was the mother, she's the mother of William Katz, who's an actor who in the 70s on TV, he was on a show called The Greatest American Hero, a very cute-looking blonde man who, had a, maybe not an amazing career, but he was quite a success on TV for a while.
I see.
But I guess the main thing is
well, so Della and Perry and Paul, they all sort of have a dynamic going on together. Like, Paul comes into the office. He's always like, hey, beautiful.
Yeah.
That's like his catchline.
Yeah, hey, beautiful.
Yeah. And they always kind of, like, walk her by the elbows, like, on either side. Yeah. He's got this entourage of, like, handsome gents.
Yes, he does. But she's got it all under control. Mm-hmm. She's the best.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there really isn't much more until we get into the Errol Stanley Gardner techniques and so forth before we talk about it. So we will talk about him. Errol Stanley Gardner was born in 1889.
Mm-hmm. He's the author of the books that Perry Mason is based off of.
He's not only the author of the books, but when Perry Mason went on TV, he formed a production company called the Paisano production company.
That's right.
And it was his production company that actually created the Perry Mason show. And I think that this is really important because once you get into it, the books, even though the TV shows vary in terms of the plot development from the books, because the books are long and you can't do the full book on a one-hour TV show, nonetheless, they keep to the structure and the spirit because he reviewed every script and he would take those scripts into the writers and tell them what they should and shouldn't do and kind of keep it into the true quality and spirit of the way he wanted these books to be done.
Right.
And so he kept a very strong creative control over his creation. So you're getting the real Perry, I think. And in fact, when they did the auditions and they had the various Perrys auditioning, he said Raymond Burr, what did he say? Raymond Burr was not born to play the part, but Raymond Burr was Perry Mason, or no one else could be Perry Mason.
I think that's what he said.
So we have it from his very lips that Raymond Burr is Perry Mason.
Right. Side note, Raymond Burr, the only thing that I knew him from before having watched this show was, of course, Rear Window.
Where he plays the killer.
He's much older in that movie. He has gray hair and everything.
Yeah, he's not actually older. He's younger, but he plays
older. I didn't notice that. anyway, it's a funny part because he has to kind of play this black hole, a void of a person. And that, and he's very intimidating. You know, his like broad-shouldered mattressness is more...
intimidating and scary.
To block out the light of the doorway. And so it was really interesting to see him in this show, all like with that like fire in his eyes, the cool fire.
The
in his
scary,
eyes.
The evil intent.
Right. Yeah.
I have to say, when he if you haven't seen Rear Window, you should. It's fantastic.
Hitchcock, of course.
Alfred Hitchcock. And there's one point where, I guess let's not digress onto Rear Window right now.
So
we'll get to that later.
That's where Raymond Burr, that's where I had seen Raymond Burr in popular culture before this show.
Yeah.
But he truly is Perry Mason, I think.
There's just nothing else. And it's fantastic that he got that role because he did it so well. And his mattressy shoulders then become the ideal vehicle for a woman to put her head on for comfort.
That's true.
Isn't that true?
All of his female clients, you know, there's always like sort of like a little bit of crying into the shoulder, a clasping of the arm for moral like support.
Yeah, something like that. But chaste.
Absolutely.
No worries.
He's a paragon of virtue.
He totally is. He's the best.
Yeah.
Anyway, Errol Stanley Gardner, what's interesting is he became a lawyer, and as with so many lawyers, he didn't want to practice law if he could possibly avoid it. He wanted to be a writer, and he became a writer of pulp fiction. He wrote tons and tons, really hugely productive guy. He wrote all kinds of different series and short stories and novels and all kinds of things before he really came up with Perry Mason.
And now from my impression of what you told me about him after having read up on him, he wasn't necessarily even like an artist burning for like
he was a technician. He just wanted to produce, and there are a lot of writers that way, which is fine. He wasn't trying to produce art. He wanted just to produce a saleable product. So he was kind of a manufacturer of books, and he was not a particularly good writer. So what he did is he worked on to train himself on how to figure out what the market wanted and how he should write the book so that it would sell. That's really what his focus was. What can I write that will sell? And so he went about that in many different ways. And one of the ways really was to get feedback from publishers of these, what they called at the time, wood pulps. Now we call them pulps. But the wood pulp magazines were printed on rough paper that almost had chips of wood in them that you could see, and are
very cheap.
Very cheap. But they were with the boys. They were like boys' magazines, like westerns and adventure stories, mm-hmm. and
a little bit gritty.
Yeah. Conan the Barbarian was like one of those one of those very famous ones that has come down to us. And so he wanted to write for the pulps. Well, actually what he did is he wanted to write sellable stories. He actually wanted to write for what they called the slicks. And the slicks were those like Atlantic Monthly or magazines where the papers were glossy and actually slick, basically. But he had to start with the pulps and work his way up to the slicks, and that's how he went. And just, he was really an amazing guy. Actually, I was not very interested in him at all. I was just interested in Perry, and when I started reading up on him, I thought, my God, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah.
He really is. He started, his very first fiction sale that he ever sold was in 1921, and Perry was published in 1933, so right. This is,
over beginning of his career.
Yeah, exactly. And I love this. It was a short fiction sale called Nellie's Naughty Nighty. And he sold it to Breezy Stories. That's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Love that.
I love it. And it's just a really funny little story about a man who's on a train. Of course, everything comes from the male perspective. Everything is from the male point of view. He never wrote anything from a woman's point of view that I know of. Or if he did, he didn't do it very well. It just really wasn't his strong suit. But Nellie gets on the train, and this traveling salesman is on the train, and she has a berth, and he sees her in her silk nightie for some reason. And then his wife is not quite so, apparently, they kind of indicate she's not so very
fulfilling,
yeah, very adventurous, whatever. And so the next morning he gets up and he looks in the berth, and Nellie has accidentally left her nightie in the berth. Nothing happened between them. He just finds this filmy, pink, beautiful nightie, and he puts it in his case, and when he gets home, he forgets about it. His wife unpacks his case, because that's what wives did. They, they're like body servants in a way. And she finds this nightie, and so with the upshot of the story is that she puts it on and kind of like says, and I think the hint was is that she didn't think he did anything. She didn't think he did anything.
Yeah.
But she was kind of like,
I can take that role on.
Yeah. I'm, So anyway, that was cute. And then he just wrote lots and lots of stories, and then he started writing books. But he really started with the stories. And the thing that I like about Errol Stanley Gardner,
He got rejected a lot, didn't he?
He got rejected a lot. And it was a guy's world and not PC. And they just laid it on the line. And there's one that I just loved, where he sends in a story and he gets a rejection letter. Dear Mr. Gardner, this is terrible. Sincerely, H.C. North, Associate Editor. And there's another one that I just thought was so funny. He got a rejection letter, and the editor had sent it to, I guess, the associate editor or somebody on the editorial staff, and they wrote a note back to the editor. And in the editor, he says, "This story gives me a pain in my neck. It's pretty near the last word in childishness, and the plot has whiskers like unto Spanish moss on a live oak. I foresaw the end from the beginning. The characters talked like a dictionary. The story was puerile, trite, obvious, unnatural, and the note was signed PCC. So what happened was the editor inadvertently included that note when he returned the manuscript and the rejection note, right? So Gardner gets it. And what I love is he's just so intent on being successful. He doesn't let his ego get in the way. And so he writes back after they got that note. I want to thank you for your criticism of my story, The Shrieking Skeleton. I am revising the story as per your welcome suggestions and will resubmit it when finished. Knowing what you want, I believe I can fill the bill. I also wish you to extend my thanks to your circulation manager, whose pencil note accompanied your letter. There's something genuine and human about his exasperation, and he expresses himself so much to the point that I've chuckled over it all day, in spite of the fact that I'm the target of his remarks. I have been in the law game long enough to keenly appreciate the fellow who can, in quotes, hand me one. And any man capable of registering so much disgust on so little paper is an artist. And so I'm going to revise this story so it will get under his skin, and wish you would try it out on him when I resubmit. Now that is an awesome response.
Yeah.
That's a successful person.
Totally.
So during this period, he's practicing law. He's got a law firm. He hates it. He wants to be a writer, but he's in order to make a buck. And which is actually probably a really good thing, because his knowledge of the law and courtroom procedure and all the things he does, he brings into play, because every Perry Mason mystery, even though there's a like a detection part of it, mm-hmm. is really about the courtroom. It's really about objecting and motions and points of law that happen in the courtroom.
Right.
Which I thought was pretty fascinating. And in fact, when he wrote his books, he knew that he would get letters from lawyers going, oh, that's not right, or, oh, you know, that's you got that all wrong. So he would write a brief. And a brief is something that a lawyer writes explaining a point of law or explaining the case or the basis for their assertions and so forth in a case. And he would write one of those for a book.
Every novel.
And then when he would get the objection, oh, this is baloney, he would write back, he would send them back a copy of the brief and say, well, it's based on this. And he said he knew he was stretching it.
Sure.
He knew he was going way outside and stretching it.
Dramatic.
But it was based on something real in the law, which I think is one of the things that makes Perry Mason so successful. It's really grounded in real law. So it makes it kind of exciting because it sets up parameters for him that he can't just go anywhere.
Right.
Like I watched Boston Legal one time and I couldn't stand it. I absolutely could not stand it because you're like, that would never happen.
Yeah.
That's just bullshit. It just would never happen. And so when you're watching Perry Mason, you know it's kind of within parameters. Another show that I really like called Damages. Yeah, it's out there. And some of the behavior is out there. But a lot of the legal points they bring up are actually within the law. So it makes it very interesting.
It's cool.
And it creates boundaries for the artist, and then the artist has to work within those boundaries, and that often creates better art,
right?
In my opinion.
Now, just for the listeners, you went to law school, so you also have a perspective on this.
I do.
And wasn't there more? Didn't he do something with the names of the characters, the names of the places that these were set in?
Yeah, and that's pretty standard stuff. Every John Grisham does it, everybody. And basically, when you use a name for somebody in a book like this, you have to check and make sure that they're...
it's not libelous.
Yeah, not somebody in the phone book in that same place who could say, oh, you're somehow casting aspersions on me and that type of thing. So he did. He kept notebooks and files full of every name that he used and had them cross-checked. And he also made sure that he didn't use the same names again. Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. How he would take a map and the last name of his characters would be a place name.
Right.
And what was the first name? How did they create the first name? I forget now.
I'm not sure either. I think maybe he just kind of would cross-check them, just kind of make something up and cross-check it. But that's the thing. We love his names. We don't really love his writing that much, but we love the names that he gave to all of his characters. They are pulpy.
Like Sims Ballantyne.
They're so good. Sims Ballantyne, right?
That's a good one.
Hamilton Burger, Hamburger, of course.
Yes.
what else?
I can't remember. Do you remember any of the other ones?
There's
some good ones. And so he had the system for making up names because it was hard to make up names. So he just used a place name. You get a map and use a place name for the last name.
Right. Dr. Babb.
Dr. Babb. I like Dr. Babb. That's a good one. And then, so as he was going on, he learned more and more how to write. But before he ever created Perry, he created a whole bunch of different series. He wrote a bunch of different series. Perry Mason ended up making him one of the best-selling author in the entire world.
Up until about the 80s?
Yeah, up until about 1980, and then other ones took over, especially like Twilight and Harry Potter and all that ended up. But he's still in the top 10, I think, in the world, which is pretty amazing given that, as we said, we read one book. We read the Perry Mason Solves the Case of the Screaming Woman, and it was rough.
Yeah.
It was work.
Yeah.
It was work getting through this thing. I don't know why people loved reading them, but
yeah.
I mean, it's not bad. It's just not, it's rough.
It's rough. It's pedestrian. We said that too. You know, he'll come up with a fun metaphor every once in a while, but it's really...
Yeah, and it doesn't flow really well. It's obviously very well thought out, and maybe that's what makes it not flow.
Yeah.
And I didn't enjoy... I loved the show, but I have to say the book... I'd be hard-pressed to read another one.
Yeah.
And I read one before this years ago, and I had the same feeling about it, so it hasn't changed. But some of his other series were... There's one called... the character is called Ed Jenkin, and it was The Phantom Crook. Everybody had kind of like this... name this epithet. Epithet? Yeah, I guess it went with him. And then this is my favorite one. He had a character named Dash Speed.
That's right.
Dash Speed, and he was the human fly. And I made a note of this, and one of the books, the title was The Case of the Misplaced Thumbs.
Where did they go?
I know.
Where did those thumbs go?
That is pretty, pretty awesome. And so basically, what Gardner set out to do, maybe this is why his writing is turgid, to my feeling.
Yeah.
But even though it's fast-paced, it's turgid, you know? I think it was successful in the pulp, and maybe that's why. Because he figured out how to create kind of a formula. And there have been a lot of things written about the formulations that he used. But really, when we look at them, they're not formulaic. How can I say this? It's like you look at them and you know that you see the pattern every time. It's always the same kind of pattern. Yet there is a surprise to it.
Yeah, it's especially in the TV show. Couldn't exactly talk.
Well,
about
I'm assuming
the books,
that is because he oversaw all those TV shows,
right?
So he made sure that they had the elements that he was looking for. So I'm
right,
just basing it on that.
I think, and maybe with visuals, you can kind of mix it up more. I'm not sure, but like, yeah, they'll start out, and sometimes you'll start with Perry. He'll be in a situation. He'll meet some people, and then something will ensue from that. But sometimes it's completely. You start with the murder-related characters, and they have a whole dynamic, and you learn a lot about them, and then the murder occurs, and it tries to throw you off, and then they go to Perry, and he comes in. So it is different almost every time. There's always at least 6 or 7 characters that we meet.
Yeah, you have to, because otherwise he can't throw in the red herring or make it... Either he can't make it... It helps him make it not obvious who the murderer is, but also that he doesn't like bring in somebody that you don't know at the very end and throw it in there, which doesn't feel fair.
Right. It's not satisfying.
It's always going to be that pool of people.
Yeah.
So you always know it's one of the people that you've met.
And now, he had tools to write these to sort of help him with plot points and things like that, right?
Well, he kind of did. It's more stuff that he created because let's see, what was that thing? There was one thing that he used,
Was it the murderer's ladder?
Or was No. There was actually a book. He actually bought a book that I can't believe I didn't make a note of this because it's so fantastic. He actually bought a book, or it wasn't even a book. It was a little cardboard spinner thing.
Okay.
That they sold. Oh, and you'll never. This is 50,000 different plots, and you'll never repeat the same plot. So he got it and. He actually didn't use it to write his stories. He used it to sort of educate himself about what the elements of plot are and the kinds of things you can use. So ultimately what he came down to, because we looked at a lot of different things, and he had the murderer's ladder, he had all these various things, but really when you look at it, he doesn't follow them all strictly.
Not necessarily.
But I think it's more like he got the technique under his belt, and then he could riff on the technique. Because when you watch the Perry Mason episodes and you read the book, you can see you always kind of know where you are, and you always kind of know what's going to happen, even though if you don't always figure out who the murderer is.
Yeah.
Or what the incidents are going to be. So you do feel like you're in a known structure. But so I think that's really where his talent is, and I think that's why those books were popular.
There's one thing that I really like. So he had this thing called the Murderer's Ladder, which supposedly you kind of work your way up through the steps, and it'll lead you through the plot of a murder mystery, right?
Right, right.
And so, you know, you have a dynamic.
Okay. This is what they came up with. The Murderer's Ladder is, number one, you have to have the motivation. Number two, the temptation. 3, the plan. 4, the opportunity. Well, that's pretty standard. You can't have a murder without those things. 5, the irretrievable step, meaning the murderer took a certain step and now there's no going back. But the thing is, we figured out a lot of times it's the actual killing itself that's the irretrievable step.
Right.
Up until that point, they could have gone back.
Right. Occasionally, they'll be like, you know, oh, the murderer was trying to get blackmail, and so they were hiding in the closet, but then they were discovered, or something like that. That was the irretrievable step.
Yeah. Or they put the poison in the wine.
Right.
And then they couldn't retract at any point until the wine was drunk or something like that.
Yeah. So that one's kind of...
Yeah. And then there was the actual killing.
Number 6.
Number 7, the flight. Number 8, the cover-up. Number 9, the false suspect, which, of course, is in every novel. It's the Perry's client is always the false suspect. And 10, the necessity for eliminating the little overlooked clues and loose threads. So, I don't know. We read this in the book called Secrets of the World's Best-Selling Writer, The Storytelling Techniques of Errol Stanley Gardner by Frances and Roberta Fugit. And this book was published in the 80s. And they seem to have... they read a lot of Errol Stanley Gardner's like private notes and notebooks, and you know, and he wrote everything down. This back right. in the day when you took a lot of notes, and they constructed this. And I honestly think that it's really not a ladder so much as elements that he could pick and choose from. I mean, there's always the motivation, there's always the temptation, there's not always a plan.
No.
Sometimes
it's just sort of an on the spur of the moment panic,
or it's an accident. They accidentally killed a person when they were in maybe a tussle or something. Obviously, there's always the opportunity. There's always the actual killing. Always, pretty much always. Well, the flight depends on what you mean. Like flight from the scene of the crime, usually. Always the cover up. Always the false suspect, which is Perry. Yeah. And we should note that Perry's
his clients are always innocent.
Always innocent. He doesn't even bother with people who are...
No. He can see... He just laser his eyes right through you and see if you're not.
Yeah, he does. Those bedroom eyes just pierce right through you.
So, now, there was something that kind of intrigued us both. Maybe it wasn't the murderer's ladder. It was another tool that was formulated. But there was something about a minor villainy that always occurs. And that's usually what leads that client... to Perry, right?
Yeah, it seems to be, and we weren't able to figure out who the minor villainy could be have done by anyone. So, for example, in the case of the screaming woman, the minor villainy is someone comes to Perry. Well, there are a couple different ones. Yeah. One, they come to Perry and they lie,
right?
Because they want to kind of cover their tracks. But the woman goes to a doctor's office. This guy's been selling babies.
Right.
And she wants to get the records.
Right.
Right? Is that right? Yeah.
She had a younger brother who had been part of this sort of baby laundering operation, and she was tracking him down, I think. And so, she wanted the records.
Right. So she goes in there, and I believe she steals the records out of the office.
He's murdered, or he gets struck down while she's in the office. She runs in there and happens to grab the book before running out.
Oh, thank you for remembering that.
In the position to be a suspect.
These are always very complicated.
Right. So that was the minor villainy, was taking the theft after the murder had occurred.
But I would suggest that in this particular book, the minor felony actually usually occurs like right at the beginning. It's like one of the first things. So the first minor villainy here is that the husband, who is helping this woman, who's not his wife, but he's not having an affair with her. Anyway, but he's helping her. He takes her there. He waits for her. He takes her to a motel room, drops her off, and then he comes home to his wife. And he concocts this lie to his wife about this hitchhiker that he happened to pick up. And she just happened to not have any gas. And she didn't have any money. And so he took her to a hotel and paid for a room so she could have it until she could get straightened out, blah, blah, blah. And he comes home. And so it's the lie to the wife, because then the wife goes to Perry and asks for his help. Right. So that's really what initiates actually the entire chain of events that involves Perry Mason.
Now, the actual murder in the story also has a minor villainy, because he is actually waiting in the closet to try and get blackmail material on his employer, happens to be discovered and kills
him. That's the murderer, not the man we're talking about, the murderer. See how complicated this is?
I know. But yeah, so I would posit that maybe most characters in a Perry Mason plot have a minor villainy on their conscience.
Oh, I think they do, but that's not necessarily the minor villainy that puts the plot in motion.
Right.
Sometimes a minor villainy is the actual client of Perry's. It's just like a little small thing they did, or some other person. And then, because there are some of these shows we watch, there's no minor villainy. The guy just kills a person. A lot of times blackmail is the first minor villainy. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be one that's pretty consistent. In all the books, if you watch a Perry Mason episode, you'll see some sort of minor villainy And then there's a bunch of other steps they have in this list, but I think that's the only one that is really consistent. One of the other ones is there's suspense through the hero's mistakes, meaning the client does something. I assume it's the client. Right. Because Perry never makes a mistake, I'll tell you that.
He's beyond a hero. He's a demigod.
That's true. So basically, Gardner set up a lot of these techniques. There's in the back of this book, there's this gigantically huge appendix that has all of these steps and possibilities and various ways that you could go. It's called the fluid or unstatic theory of plots that they kind of derive from his notes. But the fact is that there were some basic standards. So I'm going to come up with my own list.
Okay.
And the first one is what Gardner, and he hit this again and again and again whenever he talked or wrote or whatever. It's called the common denominator. And I think we call it the lowest common denominator. Basically, what is the most basic motivator that you can have? You have to have that. It can't be something erudite or something arcane. It's got to be something like basic.
Money, love.
Right.
Lust.
Fear. Mother love, which is he does that one a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So I think there's some basics that Gardner went. First of all was the common denominator. So it really, it had to be something that was really gut level. That seems so obvious, but apparently he had a lot of trouble with that when he first started writing the pulps. So it was a really big deal for him to be able to come to that. I'll tell you, my hit is that, and I don't know if this is true, but just my hit, is that Gardner was not much of a reader. Because I think if Gardner was a reader, that just wouldn't even have been anything he had to think about.
Yeah.
Because any good books, good stories, always have that in them. So it's sort pretty obvious.
Those very important themes that they always talk about in poetry
right.
and prose and everything.
And it seemed that he had to learn it.
Didn't have time to read because he was writing so many fucking books.
Yeah, that's true. And practicing law at the same time.
Right.
So that's probably true, and I think it's too bad it was so hard for him. But he got there, but he had to work really, really hard to get that because he writes it in all of his notes. Every time he talks to the writers for the show, apparently he would bring this up. He just hammered it home all the time. So obviously it was a big discovery for him.
Yeah,
but it seems pretty basic to me. The other thing is that he said that character he learned in his pulps feedback and so forth, is that character conflicts, they have to be human emotions and situations that flow out of relationships, and actions must be logical. So I think the poorer writers, especially in the pulps, and I think we see this sometimes, and we've read books where you go, why did they do that? Or somebody, just in order to get the plot to go forward, somebody does some action, but doesn't seem to come out of their feeling or the relationships or what's actually flowing in, as a human being. And so he would try to avoid that at all costs. So he really hammered down a lot of his character so that everything they did flowed out of that common denominator feeling or the relationships. And he also was into minimal setup and exposition, and this came from some feedback he got where they're like, well, this is fine, but oh my gosh, it's halfway through the story before anything happens. So he gets right to it. I mean, the action starts pretty much on the first page.
Yeah, either they're knocking on Perry's office door or
the
murder is about to occur.
Right. Yeah. Or somebody's found the body. Or usually the minor villainies on the first page is like some old man or not always, but some old man is yelling at his heir that all they want is his money or something, you know, something like that. And so the way Gardner put this in quotes, this is what he said. He says, smash him between the eyes right at the start. That's it. Bam! and then he said, then it has to be action, action, action. And he stated this is, then rush them off their feet and don't let up until the end of the story.
So we were talking about Earl Stanley Gardner and his awesome naming conventions.
Well, and all of his, he had really amazing pocket full of techniques that he used. He was quite, I don't know, I think he was very precise, and he wanted all of the information. He wanted a realism. He wanted a level of realism that where the reader would not end up questioning, or be pulled out of the story because something didn't seem realistic. So, but he also, at the same time, as particularly as a lawyer, but certainly as a writer, he wanted to be very cautious he didn't get sued for libel.
Right.
So that he didn't put anything in there that anyone could come back and say, oh, you're painting me as the murderer.
Right.
You know?
That's my name and I live in that place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or that's my license plate number. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that was the murder car. So he had a lot of techniques. And we got to remember, this was the time before computers. So there were no computers. Everything was done by, you know, paper file, and everything had to be looked up in that way. And he had like 6 or 7 secretaries at the height of his writing career, which is pretty amazing, keeping track of everything. And but we can start with the names, because I do think the naming conventions are really cool.
So we mentioned a couple of awesome names. For example, Motley Dunkirk. It's a great name.
Yeah, I love it. And Sims Ballantyne.
So good.
We like that one as well. And really, what he would do is he would get an atlas and he would write down place names, like a list of place names, and those would be the last names. And then he would add a first name to it, whatever struck him. I get like how I got Motley out of that. That good name.
Right. And then he'd go check up and make sure there was nobody of that name, right?
Well, he wouldn't do it, but he would have it checked. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, but the thing is that one of the reasons he did it this way is so that he could show the provenance of the name. He could show, I got the name from this atlas, it's this place name, and he could show that, so he could show that he wasn't choosing a person and then portraying them as a bad guy. So, you know, it's very clever, I think. And then he also would buy guns. He had one of the biggest gun collections, apparently, in the country. It was just a huge collection of guns. But he would buy one every time he needed a gun in a murder mystery, which is very, very frequently. And then he would use that serial number off that gun.
Yeah, so it would only ever be his gun.
Right, exactly.
And it would be a real serial number.
Right, exactly.
For similitude, yeah.
Exactly. He was very concerned about that. Same thing with license plate numbers. He would use car license plate numbers of his cars or his staff or his family or friends. And he would always he wouldn't make up a license plate number. He would use a real one. But he would make sure it was for somebody that he knew. And he also kept all of this information in files. He kept every serial number, every license plate number, every name in a file with all these cross references, so that on every book he could check, because he often would unconsciously maybe use the same name. He did that with plots too, because he wrote so many books.
Right.
That he was concerned about that he'd repeat a plot. So every time he wrote something, he would go back, or he'd have somebody go back for him and check and see, is this a duplication? And then if it was, he'd throw it out and start again.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very prolific and
diligent,
really,
yeah,
well-organized guy, I have to say. But the one name, actually, I don't want to pass this by without talking about Perry Mason's name, because Perry Mason's name is not a place name. And it is basically was originally a real person. And I love this story. I think it's so great. When he was a child, Errol Stanley Gardner read this magazine. He loved it, called the Youth's Companion. That's a hard one to say.
Youth's
Companion. And it was a magazine, a children's magazine that he read. And it was published by the Perry Mason Company. And obviously, I assume that the founder of the company was named Perry Mason somewhere down the road. Maybe not. But he took that name and named his main character Perry Mason, which I think is really sweet.
It is, yeah.
I like that a lot.
That nostalgia.
Yeah, exactly. And he also kept a master list of all of his characters, again, to avoid duplication, and also to avoid continuity errors. So he would have any and every character, but particularly the leads, the main characters that we talked about. He would have a list of their characteristics, their traits, what they looked like, what they wore, their personal histories, their offices and home layouts. He had them all in the file so he didn't make a mistake. But what was really funny is one time he actually, a mistake did slip through, where in one book, in the earlier book, Paul Drake's office was on the floor below Perry Mason in the same building. And in the next book, with no explanation, it's on the same floor as Perry Mason. And so a diligent reader writes in and complains that you made a mistake. And he says, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't make a mistake. In fact, what really happened was that the landlord doubled the rent on Paul Drake's office, and Drake threatened to move out because he was mad, because I guess another business wanted to move into that space, so he was going to double Drake's rent, and Drake threatened to move out, and he got really mad. So the landlord said, "Okay, wait a minute. I've got another space upstairs next to Perry Mason's office, so I can move you up there for the same rent. Is that okay? And so Paul Drake moved up. And that's what happened between those two books.
Uh-huh.
And that's why he was in a different office.
Of course.
Gardner was amazing. He really was. And to look at him, to me, he looks like kind of a stolid, outdoor, you know, Midwestern, not very lively guy. But he really had a lively mind and a very mm-hmm. funny personality.
Yeah.
Another really interesting thing about Gardner is I think all of his poetry and his artistry really went into his titles, because the books we talked about are very workmanlike, right?
Yeah.
But the titles are fantastic. You know, there's always the case of something. The case of the drowning duck was
right.
a good one. The case of the curious bride.
Right.
You know?
The case of the stuttering
Bishop.
Yeah,
exactly. But what would happen is he would come up with these titles. No idea what they meant, what they related to. And then he'd write a story after creating the title.
Hmm.
So obviously he'd have to figure out some way to work it into the, like a drowning duck. He'd have to figure out some way to work that in. And we
right.
saw him do it.
Yep, he did it. It's coating a duck's feathers with a certain chemical to make it sink, which gives a clue to the murder.
Yeah, what was it? Oil.
Yeah.
Yeah, so made the duck sink. Was it oil? Or took the oil
chemical.
Off.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
right. You're right. That's right. So that was it. But the duck.
Workaround. Good workaround.
The duck didn't even
drown. That's true.
So.
A lovely child plucked it out.
Yeah,
of water.
Saved it from drowning.
Just so you know, there's no animal cruelty
yeah.
in that episode.
The nearly drowned duck.
Yes.
Yeah. That's great. And the final bit of trivia about Errol Stanley Gardner that I just adore is in the 20s, well before he was writing Perry Mason, back in the late teens, early 20s, when he was just trying to figure out how to write. He used a device called, well, he didn't really use it. He bought a device called Plotto, Plotto. And it was guaranteed that you will have thousands of plots for your books. And
never to repeat a plot.
Yeah, never duplicated. And it was like, a cardboard wheel that would be turned and, you know, and then match up different characters with different plots. And, of course, some of them were just absolutely ludicrous. And he didn't really ever use it for his writing, apparently, but he did play with it and, you know, maybe work out some plots and things just for self-education. But I love this Plotto. It's so
yes.
1920s.
Isn't it?
I wish they'd come up with something like that today.
Yeah.
Plotto.
I said that I thought it sounded like a robotic butler, kind of.
And did we sing our Perry Mason song last time? We did, didn't we?
I think we did. We could sing it again, mm-hmm. just to see if we get a better take, you know.
Would you want to? I think that take was really good.
Okay.
We'll
leave it
I'm good
then.
With that, yeah.
Okay. All right.
One of the things that was also interesting about Gardner, not only was he indefatigable as a mechanic of writing and getting his mechanics straight and using his imagination, he also was a great marketer. He was all about marketing. He really understood that you had to produce something that people wanted to read. So he didn't write for himself. He totally wrote for an audience. And one of the ways he did that was, since he was writing in the 20s and 30s, this was between the Great Wars, the two World Wars. And so what he would do is he would hire World War I vets who were sort of down on their luck. But these are the kinds of guys who would read his stories. And he'd get the magazines and he'd give them to the World War I vets. And they'd take them out and he'd hire them to pass them out. And then get feedback from people. Like, so all their buddies and everything. And then they'd bring him the feedback. So this
cool.
is before they could do market research or whatever. He did his own. And he devised ways to reach out to his reading audience, people who would read his book, his magazines and
not
so forth.
Not just critics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he did move from the pulps to the slicks eventually, and then he got it, once he got Perry. I think really once Perry Mason was published, it was pretty successful right at the beginning, and he just, from there, he became one of the world's best-selling authors. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Really an amazing guy, and a likable guy. He was not somebody that I really... thought I would like or be that interested in, but he really had a spirit. He had a lot of verve.
Yeah.
He's really kind of that turn of the century, early 20th century.
Scrappy gentleman.
Get up and go, Sinclair Lewis Babbitt kind of guy. You know, I really like that. And then, so he became very successful and created the Perry Mason
franchise.
I was going to say franchise, but they didn't really do any marketing. What do they call that? The stuff, the pick, the dolls, the
merchandising.
Yeah, merchandising. They didn't do that. Although, wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be great.
Oh, I want one of those.
A Perry Mason
and Adela. Oh, I want them all. I want to collect them all. Oh, that'd be so great. That would be so great. But
The Screaming Woman.
Yeah.
We read this novel. It was an early one, right? In Stanley Gardner's Ove. And then we watched the episode that was based off of The Screaming Woman, which is also at the very beginning of the TV series. It's in the first season.
Yeah, if you want to rent it on DVD, they have box sets. It was in the second set. It was like number 31 or something. It was in the second half of the first season.
Right. So that was very interesting. Oh, we can pause.
Okay.
All right, so we read The Mystery of the Screaming Woman, and there is a TV episode early on in the Perry Mason canon.
First season.
So what's interesting to me about it, character-wise, because we already talked about the writing and the plot of the episode, honestly, it's completely different than in the book. Like, we were watching the episode Screaming Woman, and we didn't really recognize anything except for the baby laundering
trope. Yeah.
There's all the characters were completely different. The mystery was different. There was no hitchhiking, nothing. But the character of Perry Mason is, of course, in both. And it's interesting to see how he differs between the books and the TV show. So Errol Stanley Gardner, he wrote a lot of like detective characters and lawyer characters and stuff early on in the pulps, and his characters were kind of, Perry was like maybe the most refined of those characters.
Probably. He had cowboys.
Yeah.
He did thieves. And he did lawyers. He actually wrote a series where there was a district attorney, a crusading district attorney who was the hero.
Yeah.
But Perry was probably...
Those characters tended to be kind of like rough around the edges or rough and tumble, right?
Well, I think he had another one who was fairly refined, but Perry was, in the books, he was like the perfect combination of the two.
Yeah.
He was both intellectual, all able to handle those rigors of the law, but he also got out there and did stuff.
Right. And so in the book, I'd say compared to the show, he's even more active, even more rough, you know, breaking down not only the witnesses on the stand, but, you know, a witness that he goes to visit in her home. And, like, he's kind of, he's just a little bit more... Streetwise,
kind of tough,
something
he's
like
tougher,
that.
Yeah,
yeah, and that comes through in the early seasons, in the early episodes of Perry Mason, the show as well. He's still more refined in the show, a little bit more of a stable presence. But he, you know, he's shaking a woman by the shoulders, and being like, pull yourself together. Tell me what happened. You're lying to me, you know?
Yeah.
And she's like, ah.
And in the later episodes, you would never see him do that.
No, never. Yeah.
And he also was Raymond Burr. You can see how Raymond Burr's trying to act him.
Yeah.
And he's kind of like zipping around the room, bouncing around the room and opening doors and picking up the phone, ripping the phone out of the thing. In later seasons, you don't see that.
Right.
That ended pretty quickly. He became very kind of phlegmatic.
Yeah, more aloof.
Yeah. And then he would break out in the courtroom into a, you know...
passion.
Yeah, battering kind of energy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. I wonder if it was a choice on the part of the writers in order to sort of make the story easier to write, whether it was a progression of the character. They felt like that was more appreciated. He was more...
It works better.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
To be more aloof and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More calm, more like in charge, in command.
Yeah.
He doesn't get rattled. He doesn't get excited. He's so in charge that he doesn't even have a reaction, practically. Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that transition from book to early TV series to later TV series.
And the first episode is, I think, the only time we see him wear a hat in the entire series, even when he goes outside.
Oh, that's right. Oh, we've come to the hair.
Yeah.
Oh, Perry's hair. That's right. So we've made that observation that he never wears a hat. Most gentlemen did back in the day.
When they went outside, yeah.
Yeah. But he only does it in the first episode.
Yeah.
Which is because they're also paying for the hair when they're paying for Perry on
screen. What we think, anyway. Yeah. That hair.
Oh, it's glistens.
It's lustrous. It's kind of wavy.
Yeah.
I know.
Thick.
Thick.
You could get lost in that hair.
You could get lost in that hair. If you didn't get lost in the eyes on the way up.
So, Aaron Burr's co-star, his hair.
Raymond Burr.
Raymond Burr. Shoot. That's another mistake I make very often. Aaron Burr.
And the other thing about Raymond Burr is he had a very successful television career, because after Perry Mason, he was in a series called Ironside, where he plays a police officer, I think a police detective, who shot and is now in a wheelchair. So he investigates crimes from his wheelchair. That was dynamic, huh? And then he did Return of Perry Mason. But prior to that, he had, like you said, a small kind of character roles and B-movie roles in Hollywood. And my favorite is, beyond Rear Window, of course, is Bride of the Gorilla,
right,
where he's kind of slimmer for Perry,
mm-hmm,
and he plays a bad guy. He plays this lust-filled,
kind of degenerate,
ape man.
Somewhere in South America, in sort of a generic Hollywood South America.
Yeah. Was it South America or Africa? I couldn't tell.
It was South America.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, filled with the, like, quote-unquote superstition and stuff like that. But eventually, he gets a spell cast on him because he murdered someone. And he slowly turns into an ape in the Call of the Wild, a gorilla.
Or at least in his own mind. We don't know if he actually does or not. But he totally rocked that. And he had the dark hair and the slender for himself. Yeah, mm-hmm. for him, and kind of was digging that. So we recommend watching that if you like a B movie. That would be the one to see for sure. And he stars opposite Barbara Pater, who is the wife of Franco Tone. If you know these people, that will impress you. Yeah.
Mason.
I read online that they're thinking about doing a Perry Mason with Robert Downey Jr.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Well,
based off of the recent Sherlock Holmes
I don't researches. Know. I mean, I like him as an actor a lot. And he certainly could do it. But could he do it? But would he do it?
Uh-huh. He's certainly correctly. Not a mattress.
No, he's not a mattress. And would he be too... You know, would he be too funny? I mean, he could be snappy and have a lot of quips, because Perry does. He kind of snap. You know, he's like, snap, man. But he doesn't do it in a kind of a funny, gammon kind of way.
Yeah.
Like Robert Downey Jr. does. So I think if he decided to play it the right way, he could be all right. He's kind of short.
If it happens, we'll watch it and give y'all an update. Thank you for joining us for our inaugural episode. We want to thank David Plell of the band Power Bleeder for the theme song, Future Mind. You can look him up on Bandcamp. We also want to thank Robert Tunstall for the use of his fabulous microphone. He does a hilarious comedy improv podcast called Mouth Feels, which you can look up on any platform.
And finally, always, thanks to our beloved Scarecrow Video, a archive nonprofit of film, hundreds of thousands of films. We adore them, and we urge you to check out their website.
That's where we rented Perry Mason.